Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Hopefully you're with us every week. As you know, I do this on alternate weeks with Chris Kington Parker, and we come here to share with you lots of insightful programs about things going on the Central Coast. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and a lot of insights about things that are going on in our community and what the diversity of the community is. And we want to address basically today's choices and how it affects tomorrow's community and how things you do today have long-term ramifications on our society. Today we're going to talk about smoking. We're going to talk more about why we'd probably like you to consider looking at smoking as something that should be a thing of the past, but in a lot of cases is not. But we'll get into that in a little bit with my guests. I want to remind you that Central Coast Voices is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, which is an organization attached to the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. And Action puts out a report every 3 years called Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County. Last report came out just a little over a year ago. We're working on the next report already. You can see that entire report at www.actionslo.org. It's a 300-plus page report, which is available to you for download or for review online at no charge. It gives you a snapshot of things going on in the community and things that we're working on to both improve and look at ways to better serve the community. It's not what Action does. It is actually what Action does some research on to better support and give a broad understanding to a lot of organizations that are part of that organization and what goes on in your county. Our county, sorry about that. Today we're going to talk about decreasing smoking and saving lives and therefore for a lot of people also saving money. Tobacco is still the single most preventable cause of death and disease and disability in the United States. Annually, the care for smokers from a medical standpoint costs over $18 billion just in the state of California. It's an expense and a decision that people make, and sometimes they don't make it as a clear decision, that they have a lot more control over than a lot of them think they do. And we are going to be joined today by Kitty Farhar. She is a health education specialist and certified tobacco treatment specialist with the County of San Luis Obispo, and also Melissa Peters, who is also a health education specialist. They're both with San Luis Obispo County. And Don M. Dunn, who is the project director of the Santa Barbara County Tobacco Prevention Settlement Program. And we have all of those folks with us today. Kitty and Melissa are in the studio. Don is with us by phone from Santa Barbara. And welcome. Don, since you have the disadvantage of not being in the room with us, I'm going to start out with you on a couple of observations that you made in the material that you had provided with us. And I tried to sort things out and get a sense of whether or not how it was seen in Santa Barbara County and how it was seen in San Luis County were different. And what I really discovered is there's an incredible consistency, and that is everybody knows it's a problem that has to be solved, and everybody's looking for other ways to solve it. So what are you doing down in Santa Barbara?
Well, we are, first of all, hello, and thank you for inviting me, and thanks to all your listeners. And, you know, the thing about tobacco prevention and control is that it's a moving target. Things change very much, and we are always trying to evolve with the tobacco industry, who is forever, you know, they've got one mission, which is to serve their shareholders and sell their products, market and promote their products. So right now we are, we're very fortunate in our county to have a portion of the local tobacco settlement dollars, which we helped to secure here. So we provide funding to prevention, cessation, enforcement, and sometimes other evaluation type entities, agencies, and individuals to actually be out in the community doing the work, not just here in the health department. And those activities, right now we have 7 community agencies that we work with in prevention. Our community colleges and university all do cessation services. We provide medications to those who cannot access them through Medi-Cal. And Medi-Cal, and I think probably your San Luis Obispo, our guest from San Luis Obispo will talk a little bit more about the fact that Medi-Cal qualified people under SenCal, the Medi-Cal administrator in our region, are now afforded incredibly boosted benefits to medication support under the Affordable Care Act. We look at youth access to tobacco products. We work on, we actually respond to a lot of community complaints, and we do interrelate with every city and county in our office. We're working on healthy retail stores, and we're doing a tremendous amount of public education on electronic cigarettes and electronic smoking devices.
You cover a lot of territory quickly. I appreciate that. I want to remind our listeners before I talk to our other guests that this is a program that you're welcome to call into. You're welcome to join us as part of the discussion. Our phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And I encourage you, if you want to be part of this discussion, to join us during the earlier part of the hour. We seem to almost every week discover there are people who in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the program want to bop in with a late question, and it's often difficult for us to get you in the discussion that late in the program. So again, 781-3875. This is Community Public Radio, KCBX, and you're part of the community, so we'd like you to be part of the discussion. Well, we have the folks here from San Luis Obispo County also. Kitty, my first exposure to what you guys do was that when I was the entertainment coordinator for a community event down in Grover Beach, actually Stone Soup Music Fair, we were approached by your office that we were going to try and make this a smoke-free event. I'm a non-smoker. Actually, that's not true. I'm an ex-smoker. I am currently a non-smoker and have been for over 30 years. But I was thoroughly convinced that we could not get enough people to come to an event and not want to smoke, that wasn't going to be some kind of sabotage of the event. And actually, it worked out very well. So I guess there's more people, even among smokers, who are conscious of what's going on. So where do you first reach people when there's a desire to stop smoking and or prevent people from starting smoking?
Okay. Well, we reach people anywhere we can, actually, Fred. I would say we start in the school system. We have student interns, and Melissa and myself get out and do presentations into the schools. So we really focus on middle school and high school students, because we know that that's when people generally start smoking. And then as far as community outreach, we go through doctor's offices, we get referrals, we go to different community groups to get the word out there. But by and large, the most effective way I have found is through word of mouth. So folks who have come through our cessation classes tell their friends and family, hey, it worked for me, you should try it. And when you consider that San Luis Obispo has very low smoking rates, I would say under 10%, you know, we have more people definitely who are not smoking, and the smokers that we do have in our area are very conscientious about where and when they smoke. So it's not surprising that at an event such as Stone Soup, where you thought that maybe people wouldn't come because it went non-smoking, that
yeah, well, I'll jump in. I knew people would come. I actually thought we were going to end up with a struggle and an argument.
Right.
I think Stone Soup's probably been non-smoking now for about 10 years, maybe 10 or 12 years. I thought that the average smoker was more militant, and maybe then they were more militant than they seem to be now. And smokers do seem to be more aware of, can't think of a better word for it, their intrusion in their smoking in a lot of cases, and therefore they seem to be a more conscientious group. 20 years ago, smokers seemed like they would just smoke anywhere they wanted to smoke, and the heck with you.
Well,
so it's they become more conscious as a group.
Right. And I think this is something that tobacco control throughout the state has worked very hard on for many years. We're actually seeing a change in the social norms around smoking. So somebody whom you may have thought was militant about smoking, mm-hmm. because they've seen a change in the social norm, we're changing that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we have Melissa Peters here with us, too, and I want to get to you in a minute, Melissa, but we actually already have a caller, so let me go ahead. I don't want to keep John waiting too long. John, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. What are your questions or comments?
Yes. My question is this, and it's an informational question. There are many ex-tobacco smokers who are now smoking pot, and the question I have is, is there a difference in health-wise? In other words, when you're taking smoke of any kind into your system, it should be damaging lungs. What's the difference between pot smoking and tobacco smoking?
John?
This is Melissa.
This is
Go
Melissa
ahead.
Okay. From the Tobacco Control Program. Great question. We have a common phrase when we're out doing education that, that's not my booth kind of thing. I'm not well versed in the ins and outs of marijuana smoke versus tobacco smoke, but what you said is definitely what you said is definitely true. Whenever you are smoking anything, especially if you're using a combustible product like marijuana or tobacco smoke, you are creating carbon monoxide and some tar that you're breathing into the lungs. So you are doing some damage. Now, I can't quote any health studies comparing tobacco smoke and marijuana smoke, but I would go with your gut when you're thinking of lung damage. Is anything you're breathing in, whether it's tobacco, marijuana, or whatever you happen to be smoking, you are doing some health damage to your lungs and the function.
Haven't there been any studies?
Interesting thing we see with marijuana, because it is still federally an illegal drug, it is very hard to obtain research grade marijuana. So the research on marijuana is limited. It's not as extensive as tobacco research, which is widely used all the time because they're researching a legal product. They can go to the store and buy it. So that kind of puts up a difference between the amount of research we have to kind of compare the two. I know that's not what you wanted to hear, but that's all
I can give you.
I
want to hear some knowledge on, some scientific knowledge on whether or not people who are now smoking pot, who had once smoked tobacco, are in better shape health-wise.
Hmm. If I can go ahead, jump in, because that's my area is working with smokers and helping them quit. And honestly, John, I haven't seen in the 6 years I've been doing this, about 300 people a year, I have not seen people switch from tobacco to marijuana. I'm sure that this occurs, and I'm sure that some people that I work with are also using marijuana at the same time that they're smoking. But I certainly personally don't see a trend from tobacco to marijuana.
Yeah. Ernie, thank you, John. I appreciate it. That brings up an interesting question. Well, Melissa, I think you hit quite part of a real key factor, and that is if you have a product that's still illegal, it's very hard to do research and do a comparison on it.
Right.
So maybe what goes on in Colorado or goes on in Oregon at some point Washington State.
Yeah.
There may be some studies that can come out of that that we don't know about.
Right, and it's the same with all types of illegal drugs that are controlled on the schedule by the federal government. They're hard to research in general.
And also, this is Dawn.
Yeah.
I want to say that. I understand and respect that the caller thinks that these are interrelated issues, but everyone on this call is literally a tobacco specialist.
Yeah.
I'm currently on the NIDA or the National Drug Abuse website from the federal government, and marijuana raises the heart rate by 20 to 100% shortly after smoking it, and that effect can increase for 3 hours. There's a 4.8-fold increase in heart attack, apparently, in the first hour after smoking the drug, et cetera. However, what I want to say is I've been at this 25 years, and although I don't actually, we actually do very little direct cessation services these days because of the way our funding is. For 10 years, we saw roughly 500 people through our community contracts in smoking cessation, and I have answered the phone to refer and help people, as has my staff. And more often I hear that people are concerned they are tobacco smokers and they smoke marijuana, and they're more concerned about will they be able to quit smoking cigarettes and still be smoking marijuana. In other words, it's about quitting. And really, marijuana falls into the category of drugs and drug addiction, and it's just a much bigger topic and not one we were going to spend a lot of time on today.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that perspective on that, too. I think one of the things that we have to look at is, and this brings up a question I don't think we've looked at yet.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your effort, for all three of you, how much of your effort is cessation-based, and how much of it is preventing initial smoking? Because I will tell you that, I have between stepchildren and children, I have four children between the ages of 27 and 40.
Oh, geez.
And I can tell you, three of the four of them have all been smokers. Okay. I believe all three of them are now non-smokers, but sometimes your children lie to you, so you don't always know. I'm surprised. See, I thought, you know, I'm 63 years old. It's not a big secret. Okay. When I was in my early 20s, we knew cigarettes were bad, but we didn't know how bad they were, and the propaganda from the cigarette companies was still, you know, it's okay, don't worry about it. But I'm surprised that 30 years later we have that many people that start smoking in the first place.
Mm.
And that's the segment of the population that surprises me the most. I know the baby boomers, the slightly post-baby boomers, are a good portion of the smoking population. But when I see a 24, 25-year-old with a cigarette, I'm just flabbergasted. It's like, you know, where were you when the information about how bad this is for you came out?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I can speak specifically for San Luis Obispo County. This is Melissa. We have two main functions of our program. Kitty is our cessation counselor, so she runs all of our cessation efforts. So we do have a big client-to-counselor group counseling push in that section. I do only community-based education and prevention strategies. So we're funded by Proposition 99, which was the increase in the tobacco tax. And so what we do is we kind of work from the top down. So public policy, increasing awareness of tobacco use in the population, like Kitty mentioned, early presentations. It's a big part of getting out there and getting them when they're about to start to think about trying tobacco, like Kitty mentioned, at the middle and high school level.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, we're in San Luis Obispo County. We're actually working on a big push in youth engagement and tobacco control efforts to get those kids engaged in positive behaviors rather than maybe trying tobacco or other negative behaviors. We also do push for education on the local leaders on the benefits of tobacco policy and what that could do for the community. And so we do both. We do kind of have a program that's split in two, where we have a lot of our focus is on direct client-to-client services, and we also have a lot of our focus on community-based services. Mm-hmm. So it's really twofold.
Kitty, so you focus more on cessation programs.
Right,
Do you get people who come to you and basically say, I've been trying this for years on my own and it doesn't work? Do you get people who come to you and say, you know, my doctors told me I have to stop, my family has told me I have to stop? So what is the motivation for the average person that you hear from that wants to stop smoking?
Right. Well, it varies. Often it comes from the doctor telling them they have an issue. But more and more, it's people who, you know, have recognized or are feeling the effects of smoking. And the rate of success really is very variable, depending on whether they have an internal motivation to quit or somebody's just nagging them to quit. So I really see all different reasons, but usually by the time they come to me, they have tried lots of other things.
So, yeah. Don, what do you see in your work as far as what the motivation is for people to come to you, and are they pushed there or do they come on their own?
So again, at this current time, we do a limited amount of direct cessation work, and you'll see a link between where we're funded, because certain our original tobacco tax funding, of course, has dwindled a bit, and that's the Prop 99 funds. The tobacco tax hasn't been increased in more than a decade, and we're 33rd lowest in the state among the 50 states. I think that would surprise most of your callers. And
let's under back up. 33rd lowest.
Out of 50.
Okay. In taxes.
Okay. In terms of our tobacco tax.
Oh, the tax.
And so we've done a great job in the state of California keep preventing tobacco use, either by having people quit and or by just making sure that the next generation doesn't pick this habit up. And I think that's proven, and it's as a result of the great work being done by local community groups and the public health departments through these funds. However, under these Prop 99 funds, we have a limitation as to how much cessation services we can do with our allocation, and it's only 10% at most, and mm-hmm. we cannot pay for meds. It's just part of the legislation, and, you know, it's got to be a cost effective. So this leads me to tell you that we refer currently most of our callers to the California Smokers Helpline, which is available in 7 languages for the hearing impaired, for pregnant women, for people with mental health and substance abuse disorders, for teens, et cetera. And we'll give you the numbers before the end of the program. And they even help people now with accessing the medications. However, I think that the people who are still smoking now, essentially, a lot of the people that are going to be calling are either hardcore smokers, they've been at it a long time, they would have quit if it was easy for them, and they tried a lot of different things. There are also young smokers or young adult smokers, and each person has to be met where they're at. And that's why, you know, these individualized treatments that Kitty is doing, that we would do, a cottage hospital runs a quarterly class here in a group or on the mm-hmm. phone, are so important. People are unique. And the last thing I want to say about your comment about your kids is, even though you've quit, people are four to eight times more likely to smoke if a family member does. Even though you quit, at some point they saw that model.
Well,
right?
just for the record, I quit at least 15 years before I had children. But that's,
I see. So then it's not for you, right?
Yeah, which brings it, because one of the things that's a factor that's, as all three of you have been talking, occurred to me, is I did not find it really difficult to quit, but I had only been a smoker for about 10 years when I did quit. So I'm wondering whether or not someone who's been a smoker for 30 or 40 years, well, there are certain habitual patterns, even if the nicotine addiction is different, is the same even after, you know, a certain number of years, habitual patterns of what you get used to. I had found that that my best friend from high school who no longer smokes, it was difficult not to smoke around him when I first stopped smoking, because when you're around people who are your social friends or family friends all the time and they're smoking, it becomes real hard to not smoke. And I think that becomes a factor. But so if does a 20-year smoker have a more difficult time breaking the pattern than a 10-year smoker?
Yes, I think quite possibly, though I've had people who smoked for 5 years have a difficult time, and people who smoked for 50 years have a difficult time. I do want to say, you know, everybody has a story about their parent or grandparent just quitting cold turkey, no problem. And I will say that prior to about the mid-80s, cigarettes were engineered differently than they are today. And the tobacco industry, as Don said, they're always changing and we're trying to stay a step ahead. They actually made cigarettes more addictive. So that could be one reason that they're more difficult to quit now. But Fred, the behavior is very important.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that your cessation chances of quitting go up if you're in some sort of behavioral counseling support and using nicotine replacement at the same time. So if you have that support system to help you with those habits, breaking that down and using the nicotine replacement, you increase your chances of the likelihood of staying quit.
We've got some callers. Let me go ahead. Jalilo or Jaleo?
Yeah. Julio.
Julio, okay. Julio, okay. I'm sorry. I apologize. Sorry about that. And go ahead. What is your question or your thought?
I wanted to say that I was in the program of the County of San Luis Obispo with Kitty two different times, and that ultimately for me, my decision to stop smoking was just that, a decision once I had had enough. I happen to be in another 12-step program. I see cigarettes as a drug, and so I utilize that in my mind as the same process. And I use cigarette replacement therapy patches for 3 days just to sort of get over the hump. And then I decided that's it. I want to go on with my life. I want to be free of this. And so combination of what Kitty offered and my own decision and my own work personally to make my life better, all of a sudden cigarettes are no longer part of that lifestyle.
How long were you a smoker?
I was a smoker for 29 years.
Okay. So that had you tried to stop quite a bit before that?
I had probably about 7 different times, maybe 4 seriously tried to quit.
Mm-hmm. So the process worked for you.
Kitty,
go ahead.
You know, yay, Kitty. And
No, I want to say yay, Julio, actually.
Right, yay, Julio. And, you know, there's a couple of things I want to point out here. Number one, and they're things that both the San Luis Obispo program and our program had as myths that a lot of people think, which is, so number one, it takes repeated attempts. So if you've tried to quit before, you need to try it again, mm-hmm. and again, and again, and again. Each quit attempt's different, and mm-hmm. the more you set a quit date, make a plan, get the support, use the various you just keep trying, you will get there. And most people can successfully, comfortably become non-smokers. Second thing, in recovery, and that was a key component of Julio's commentary, was that, you know, whether you have substance abuse or mental health disorder, we see that a lot of those people have addiction to nicotine as well. And it's always been thought that if you tried to address that, you would threaten your recovery. You would doom yourself. And in fact, the research is pretty telling that that sort of the reverse is true, that you can improve your success. And again, it would be individual. And there was one more thing, and it's gone out of my head. Over to you, San Luis.
Okay. Well, Don, I have a question for all three of you, too. And one of the things that comes up is that, well, Don is an observer to this, maybe good, because it started in San Luis Obispo. When the city of San Luis Obispo decided to remove cigarette smoking as an acceptable behavior in restaurants.
Right.
Which seems like a zillion years ago. I'm trying to remember how long ago it was.
25.
Okay, 95, 26, okay, yeah.
So it's 26 or 7 even.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking about something that allegedly was going to ruin the economy. You know, restaurants were not going to succeed. Bars were not going to succeed. There's a couple of bars in San Luis Obispo that I know were actually defiant to the whole process and pretty much ended up having the authorities had to fight with them about it. This is before any of you, in most cases, had a program like this, I think, when this first came about. But I was pleasantly surprised that it seemed very shortly after that happened, and the smokers were still complaining, the restaurants weren't. Because they discovered actually the number of people from out of the area that came and were now say, gee, I know I can always go to a restaurant when I'm passing through San Luis Obispo and there's going to be no smokers there. I'm wondering if those kinds of at the time they were baby steps. Now it's a I don't know. Other than the state of Nevada, are there any places that have restaurants you can still smoke in? I don't know. But well,
they exist.
I'm getting some looks here. But those programs, we resisted those. A lot of people, I think, who resisted those. It wasn't even a matter of whether or not they were smokers. It was a matter of whether or not the businesses felt it would be an economic burden or an intrusion in government. So my hunch is that when you work in the programs you're working in on a daily basis, you all three of you run into people who give you a response of some version of the very fact that you're in this program annoys me. Please just leave me alone.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you brought up the restaurant and bar tobacco restriction because that is completely true. I don't know if they are complaining. They're not complaining to our office. And we often...
They're not complaining anymore.
Yeah, anymore. I mean, they've seen no economic downfall from these particular policies. And that's true across the state. Many other jurisdictions after San Luis Obispo did that. They went on forth and implied the same types of policies and then move those policies towards the outdoor space, so outdoor dining, outdoor parks, recreation areas. And what's proven to be true is those policies actually in their implementation help smokers to make it easier to quit, because when they're out at the park, when they're out at their favorite restaurant, they don't see that trigger of somebody smoking anymore. So it allows, if the community has these policies in place, it allows the smokers to have more areas where, or former smokers or people in the process of quitting, to have an area to go and feel like they can successfully be assimilated and not smoke and be in these areas.
Well, I think it becomes a selling point in a lot of environments. So it's hard to get a sense as to whether or not they're successful everywhere. I suppose the state of Nevada, I believe, still has pretty much open smoking everywhere. So, but one of the things I think is a factor is if you go to like the Chumash Casino, okay,
right.
A casino environment outside of Nevada, because I'm not quite sure how Nevada handles these. For a long time, I don't know if people still smoke at Chumash, but when I've been there on a few occasions prior to the last couple of years, I haven't been there recently, I was surprised at the disproportionate amount of gamblers in the casino who were also smokers. So I think my prejudice on this, and I will own it as no scientific fact about this, is I guess I believe that people who tend to go to public places to gamble and go to public places to drink tend to be a a population that has a higher percentage of smokers. And I'm wondering whether or not that's something that you've seen, or there's statistics available that address that.
Well, we do know that people with issues with drug and alcohol abuse do have higher rates of tobacco use. That is a fact. They go hand in hand. I'm going to let maybe Dawn has some insight, since Chumash happens to be in her jurisdiction.
Yeah. Dawn, are you there?
Yeah. Yes, I am. Okay.
Well, you didn't just jump in here yet. Like, so
what was that?
You just jump in on this one. Go ahead.
Yes, of course. So first of all, I think it's important that we do stick with what we know well and not speculate. So everything that Melissa said, I echo. I also, of course, the laws that govern tobacco use are not applicable on reservations. The Chumash Casino does still allow smoking. And in my experience as well, and basically we do go there, we monitor sales of tobacco. I will say that the Chumash are good neighbors. They do not, for example, in their gift store, need to have a tobacco retail license where we monitor their sales, and they pay an annual fee, and they do pay that fee. They are very communicative, and I think they want to do the right thing. But their patrons are smokers, and they feel that they can't afford not to have smoking. That's just my sense about it. And, you know, long ago we did some smoke-free days at the casino, and they were fairly successful, but very limited. And I know there is a project about focused on smoke-free air for casinos due to the workers and their risks. But I cannot specifically, empirically, with scientific confidence, say that gamblers tend to be smokers. But I would say, anecdotally, you're probably right on.
Well, since I don't make my living doing any of this, I'm entitled to an uninformed opinion, which is which is one reason why they let me do this show every week, because if I just acknowledge that my opinion is also uninformed, that seems to help them allow me to continue to host this program.
And may I jump in on the where you can smoke and where you can't? Off the top of my head, I can't tell you which. There are plenty of states that still allow smoking in public places, in restaurants, and indoors. Nevada is on that list, I guarantee you, and likely will be among the last to move in that direction. What's surprising to me, and recently came to my attention from a few sources, is that California's law, the California Smoke-Free Workplace Law, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary, and San Luis Obispo definitely got that going, is considered one of the 10 weakest smoking laws in the country, right, because of the loop for indoor air, because of the loopholes that exist in it. Mm-hmm. Because when it was passed, compromise was inevitable. I mean, it was groundbreaking. But 20 years later, all the attempts to close those loopholes haven't occurred, and you know, you have low-income workers, people, you know, of color, poor working people are the people who are most likely to be exposed to secondhand smoke in their workplace, least likely to be willing to complain about it or have access to the services that they need. Mm-hmm. So we know now, and there was also just a huge report about the disparities, the economic, the social inequities about exposure to secondhand smoke nationally, and this applies in the state of California. So this isn't, the issue isn't dead and buried. In other words, someone else said it today, that we still have a lot of work to do.
Well, the state of California does seem to do better as far as the percentage of smokers that we have. Let me back up. San Luis County does better than the state of California.
There you go.
Okay. I'm wondering, let's go back. I think let's revisit this. What is the place we are? We're number 33, you said?
The state in terms of tobacco tax.
Okay.
So our tax on cigarettes is 33 in the nation of states. So 33 other states have a higher tax than we do.
Okay.
We're also ranked pretty low on the amount of funds that we dedicate towards tobacco programs, which would surprise a lot of people because we talk about Prop 99 and because we do have that tobacco tax. But we also – we don't use enough funding, according to the CDC, for tobacco prevention. And then when you mentioned, you know, California does pretty well in terms of smokers. Well, California has more people that smoke in the state than some states have people. So it's to put it in perspective.
Okay, well, percentage of population then.
Yeah, it's right. We still have a lot of people that use tobacco in California, and so the services are definitely necessary. And the way that we counter tobacco influence in California is varied through a variety of different programs like smoke-free casinos that Dawn mentioned, outdoor air cessation services. But yeah, California is slowly dropping down from the leader that it was when the tobacco control program was first established.
And I do want to let you know, we're still doing terrific. The overall prevalence in California for adults is I think it's currently at 12.5,
yeah.
So plus or minus a few points. We still are among the leaders, despite our size and diversity in the nation. We are also have lower lung and bronchus cancer rates. The only thing we're trying to get your public, a listening public, to understand is that if things stay the same, and we do our job, which is to put ourselves out of a job. In other words, less people should be smoking. That's a good thing. That's what we want.
Yes.
But if we keep going and inflation keeps happening, we have 53% less dollars to spend on this than we did in 1989 when this started.
Yeah, Don nailed it.
Okay.
And if we do just what we're doing and nothing else, to attack this phenomenon. So let me say, we have a generation of children in our school system that have grown up in a California where they've never been exposed to secondhand smoke indoors in large part, which is amazing. But
we have
e-cigarettes that are, we're hearing about them sneaking them in classrooms. They're being marketed on televisions. They have 700 fruity and, you know, bacon flavor. So, no, I'm not kidding. And they're not.
But I'm a bacon lover. I resent that concept of using that as a reason. But yeah. Well, we'll get into e-cigarettes in a second because I wanted to take this one other place, and that is, are we successfully reducing the number of high school and college students who start smoking?
Mm.
In other words, is the legacy of 20 years from now that we're going to see that? There's no kind way to word this.
An end.
Okay. Well, an end, but I'm looking for an end other than all the smokers just die off.
Well, I think this is a great segue into your discussion on electronic cigarettes because I think a tentative answer would be yes, high school and middle school students are using tobacco at a lower rate across the nation.
Okay.
However, they're now transitioning to using electronic cigarettes at an extremely higher rate. So are we doing a good job getting them to off of the traditional or traditional tobacco products? Yes. Are they now transitioning to other nicotine products? Yes. So we're not – it's a two-part question because we're not getting them off the nicotine. They're just switching the products. And Kitty can –
Well, we were seeing a steady drop in the number of teens who were taking up tobacco for many years, and it has sort of started to level off. And then with electronic devices, seeing an uptick.
And
so we are
a lot of these kids think that that's a safe alternative, and from what I've read, it's not a safe alternative. But the perception for a lot of people is it's a safe alternative.
Well, I think what some of the greatest things that the nation did in terms of tobacco use among teens is they eliminated tobacco advertising of any kind on, you know, on TV, radio, magazines targeted towards youth. So youth are extremely vulnerable towards advertising at that rate.
The CVS pharmacy chain stopped selling tobacco.
CVS
products.
Is yes.
That was not a local thing. That's a national thing.
Okay. And that was their own choice, okay. Which was great. But what we're seeing is, and the reasons for the insurgence of youth taking up electronic cigarettes is the complete opposite of all of the stop holds that we put in place, is youth are now able to see e-cigarette ads on TV, on the radio, in magazines. They're advertised at sporting events. They can be sponsors at youth events. There's no restriction.
The internet.
So in the restrictions that we had on the tobacco industry targeting youth via advertising, which is a great way to get somebody to try your product, we're not seeing those same restrictions with e-cigarettes. So that's one reason.
Has anybody challenged made any effort to try and stop those as – put those in the same category with cigarettes, because if you can't advertise certain things in certain venues,
right.
But you can advertise e-cigarettes, has anybody challenged that as to whether or not, e-cigarettes and smoking cigarettes are really the same product?
From a federal level, there hasn't been an inclusion yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's talks of the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, including electronic tobacco in some sort of regulation. They haven't yet told us what that would look like. And then from the state level, state of California, the state has not made that move either. So there are bills going about up at the state legislature, but nothing's really taken hold. Local level, we have made those strides at the local level to include electronic tobacco in the same restrictions that we have with tobacco.
Good. We have Laura. Laura, we've got a couple of minutes left, but I'm glad you could call in. What's up?
Oh, am I on?
You're on.
Hi. I want to tell you a quick clip, something light on cigarettes. 50 years ago, I smoked my first cigarette in the dormitory lounge at Bible College in the Midwest, where my father was chairman of the board of trustees. I sat on the couch impressing all my friends in Bible College with this ash on my cigarette that was getting to be about an inch-long ember. I didn't know how to smoke. And the ash fell into the crease of the couch, and pretty soon it wasn't just me smoking, so was the couch. And the end of the story was very simple. My father announced in the school paper that the new couch he bought was the best money he ever spent in his life because he knew his daughter would never smoke another cigarette. I couldn't help but want to throw that in as a lighter note. I think that of all the cigarette stories I know now, 50 years later, that's very funny to me.
Yeah, we may all have some of those. Mine wasn't quite as drastic of that, but I actually burned a pair of wool pants I really liked, and I ruined a comforter that was my grandmother's that I never heard the end of. So it's just like, why are we doing this? But Laura,
well,
thanks
and,
very
and
much.
It also is a bit of a note on Bible College, which is another subject. Anyway, all four of my father's unlikely children to be Bible College graduates have survived into their 60s, so there must be some good in all of that.
Maybe are you all non-smokers now?
I think we all tried it, but my dad's only smoking was when he was in college. He smoked a pipe at the same college, Bible College in the Midwest.
Yeah,
but that was long before all of us were more than a glimmer in his eye. But.
Yeah.
Anyway, he died 30 years ago, and I often tell my mother, I wish I could thank him for being as strict as he was, and she said,
Yep.
And she's 95 now.
Laura, okay. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Actually, we've only got a couple more minutes left, but that brings up a topic we probably didn't even broach, and that was the perception that, okay, if I smoke a pipe, that's okay. If I smoke a cigar, that's okay. Gee, because if I smoke a cigar, I don't inhale it. Now, secondhand smoke obviously is there for all of those things, but we do have this misconception that there are safer ways to do this. And actually, somewhere in the material that I was reading that you folks shared with me, there's this perception that American spirit, which organic cigarettes is somehow safer than regular cigarettes.
That was one of the myths and the questions that we get.
There just seems to be a perception that that's a factor from that standpoint.
Right. So there's actually no safe way to use tobacco products. And often we'll have people who will, you know, quit cigarettes and go to smokeless or cigars, and, you know, ultimately they're just using another tobacco product. So, there's no safe way. The other thing that we know is that somebody who smoked cigarettes, they're going to inhale the cigar, whether you're supposed to or not. And I will just throw out there that the little cigars come in all kinds of fruity flavors, single packaging, very inexpensive, not directed at people my age, but directed at young people.
It's an effort to initiate people and get them starting. Start smoking.
Yes. And that's also how we view the electronic cigarette products as well, because they come in, like Don mentioned, bacon, watermelon, grape, tons of flavors that are appealing to kids that want to try them all and have that kind of mentality, and young people. Most adult smokers smoke traditional tobacco-flavored or use traditional tobacco-flavored products. At extremely high rates, youth are the ones that are buying the flavored products.
Yeah. Don, you still with us?
Of course I am.
Okay, well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I'll let you start off the some wrapping things up here. Do you feel your program is going where you want it to go, and are you successful, and where do you want to go from here?
Okay, so the first thing I want to say is we can't do what we do without community involvement. Not support. We're not looking for money. We don't need people to come to tons of meetings. But we are doing the work of the people of the state of California. All of us assess community needs, public opinion, et cetera. And we're responsive to that. Not only that, we're government employees, and we can't affect change in a local community. But everyday people with a phone call or an email or a question can do so. So we urge people not only to learn about, access the services that are available to quit smoking, learn more about e-cigarettes. And by the way, we'd love to come back on and just do a whole show on that. I'm sure San Luis would be similar, because there is so much misinformation. So I'd like to just give you our phone number. It's 805-681-5407. And
I want to remind folks, we'll actually also make sure when these programs are archived and they're available on the KCBX website, and we'll make sure the phone number is listed also on the narrative information for the program.
And I would love to send you, if I haven't already, our website and our Facebook page and things like that, so that the community can just does know that we care about what they think on either side of the issue. We represent them all. And, yes, we think our program is going in the right direction, and we love what we do, and we're here to serve.
Okay. Thank you, Don. I appreciate it. Melissa.
I'll speak for my portion of the program, and Kitty can speak for hers. Don did kind of just reiterate what I was thinking of. The community is who we serve and who we look to guide our efforts. At the local level here in San Luis Obispo, we have a tobacco control coalition that meets every other month at the health department. It's a group of community advocates and interested parties that come and meet and talk about tobacco issues. Where do we want to do work? They are the community body that directs our work plan at the program level. So they provide direct input to where and what are the problems that San Luis Obispo is experiencing, and where can our efforts be the most impactful. I think our program is headed in definitely the right direction. Everything that we do impacts somebody, and I think that's the main goal of our program. If I can make one apartment complex adopt a tobacco-free policy, then I've affected 40 families that maybe come after that complex is now smoke-free. So I think that's what our jobs are about, and I think you know, we do a good job of it. Santa Barbara does similar efforts. I think the Central Coast, you know, we're doing pretty good. Yeah. Not to say so myself.
Okay. Well, I think you can be proud of what you do, and that's fine. Kitty, so you work more with people who are trying to stop a process that probably started for them a long time ago.
Right.
How do you think that's going?
Right. Well, I think for every person who quits smoking, I feel that that's a success, certainly. I do want to remind people that it's a long and difficult process, and as Dawn pointed out, it takes often several attempts. Each time you learn something, I would like to encourage people who have tried before to try again. If it didn't work the first time, maybe we have some new approaches. We're very fortunate in San Luis Obispo County. Many years ago, when the Master Settlement Agreement money came about, and we don't have time to get into that. That could be another show. The Board of Supervisors, in their wisdom, dedicated the portion of that money specifically to tobacco prevention. So that enables San Luis Obispo County to purchase nicotine replacement products, so we really can help people. It funds what I do, and very few communities have this to offer, and I'm surprised how few people know about it here. So
I'll jump in for a second. I think maybe a lot of people don't know about it because they're surrounded by people for which smoking may not be a problem anymore. And that may be a positive factor that comes into play.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I think it just goes to show that in San Luis Obispo, the fact that we have diverted those funds to tobacco programs shows the commitment that San Luis Obispo County has to tobacco control.
Great. Absolutely.
I thank you very much. It's been a lively topic, and I'm glad that you could all join us today. I want to remind you folks that this is Central Coast Voices, and it's a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. We're looking at how today's choices affect our community tomorrow, and this is a good example of this. As I confess, as the oldest person in the room, I have seen a tremendous amount of change in smoking issues over the years. I never would have thought that Stone Soup, a public event on a public street, could be made smoke-free. I was very skeptical, and I was very pleased to see that. So I'm glad that what we talk about affects changes, and some of them are successful, and I thank my guests today. I want to remind you that next week, Chris Kington Barker is joining us again, and she is joined by Stephen Jenkinson, who's a social worker and a spiritual activist, author, ceremonialist, and farmer. And they're going to discuss his latest work, which is a book called Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. It's a book about grief and dying and a great love for life. The San Luis Obispo International Film Festival is showing Grief Walker, which is a documentary that provides a lyrical and poetic portrait of Stephen's approach to dying in North America, and that's sponsored by Hospice San Luis Obispo, and that's something that you may want to find out about, but that'll also be the topic of Chris's discussion next week. That may be, in my opinion, one of the most unusual and possibly enlightening topics we've ever had on the program. So I'll be listening. I hope you will be too. Central Coast Voices, as I've said before, is part of Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX Public Radio. This is your public radio station, and we're glad you're part of this. Our program is underwritten through a grant by Joan Gellert Sargent, and we appreciate her support of us being able to put this together for you. Your input for Central Coast Voices can be directed to voices@kcbx.org. or our phone number, 543-2323. We want to hear about what you think about the program and where you think we should go with other programs when it comes up. Thanks to Kitty Farhar, Melissa Peters, and Dawn Dunn. And we appreciate you've been with us. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us.